Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Thanks for tuning in to this Another News special. The last special broadcast goes back to when New York State health workers were mandated to take the swine flu vaccine, and we took calls from health workers only. That was a while back. Well, late last year, WikiLeaks released some emails of John Podesta. He's the former chairman of the 2016 Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. He previously served as chief of staff to President Bill Clinton and counselor to President Barack Obama. It's been reported that John Podesta himself mentions pizza 78 times and cheese another 90 or so times in those emails. Well, despite the implementation of filtering so-called fake news by the power structure, citizen journalists dug into the many levels of what's called Pizzagate and unearthed disturbing pedophile-related images, artwork, and powerful associations about a pizza restaurant owner's Instagram account and archived it before it was switched to private. That visual data exploded online as a culture of outrage and cyber mobs put Comet Ping Pong in the crosshairs of a potential child trafficking pedophile network. For many, the evidence online was enough to research deeper, but what will it take for an official investigation to commence? We're joined today by returning guest Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal. Here's the book, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal. He's here for a two-hour live interview right here at the Brooklyn Commons. And we'll also take your questions in the second hour of the interview. The massive resources being used to censor, debunk, and lie about information that could lead to evidence of a potential child trafficking and abuse network in Washington, D.C. is very telling. Let's examine the available evidence of past pedophile network cases with investigative journalist and author Nick Bryant, who will expound on the funding and cover-ups conducted at the highest levels of government. Nick Bryant's writing has recurrently focused on the plight of disadvantaged children in the United States. He's been published in numerous national journals, including the Journal of Professional Ethics, the Journal of Applied Developmental Psychology, Journal of Social Distress and Homelessness, Journal of Healthcare for the Poor and Underserved, and Journal of School Health. He's also published a book, America's Children, Triumph of Tragedy, addressing the medical and developmental problems of lower socioeconomic children in America. His mainstream and investigative journalism has appeared in the Twin Cities Reader, Salon.com, Gear, and Playboy. Nick has also co-written Confessions of a DC Madam, a firsthand account of how public officials and other well-connected individuals have been compromised or blackmailed by their sexual improprieties. Nick Bryant, welcome back to Another News.
Well, I'm glad to be back with you, Jeff.
In your book, The Franklin Scandal, the Franklin Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska is shown to be essentially a front for an interstate transcontinental pedophile network. Some people in social services came forward who knew about the credit union manager Larry King's exploitation of children. Would you please outline the sequence of events in The Franklin Scandal so listeners can get a sense of what this case is about?
I embarked on the Franklin scandal in 2002, and the book was published in 2009. So I spent 7 years researching the Franklin scandal. What I uncovered was a interstate pedophile network that pandered children to very rich and powerful people. The network was ultimately covered up by the Department of Justice and the FBI and the Omaha Police Department and the Douglas County Judiciary. When I say the Douglas County Judiciary, the epicenter of the network was in Omaha, Nebraska, and that is in Douglas County. And a lot of the kids came from the Omaha area, and they were flown from to Washington, D.C. They were also flown to Los Angeles. They were flown around the country and pandered to Lawrence King's elite pedophile patrons. I realize that the story is very fantastic. It's often been labeled as a conspiracy theory, but as Jeff said, my writing on children's issues has appeared in the Journal of Professional Ethics, Journal of Applied Developmental Psychology, Journal of Healthcare for the Poor and Underserved, Journal of School Health, and I've written a book called America's Children, Triumph of Tragedy, addressing the developmental and medical needs of disadvantaged children. So I didn't come at this as a quote-unquote conspiracy theorist. I came at this as a child rights advocate. And ultimately, what I found was a massive interstate network that had been covered up. And it was used for blackmail, and we can get into that a little bit later. I spent, as I said, 7 years of my life. I knew that the bar was very high for this story because to accuse the Department of Justice and the FBI of covering up a child trafficking network is very grave. And I knew that the bar was really high, and I worked on it for 7 years, and I gave 7 years of my life to it. What I ultimately got, there were three grand juries that were used to cover up this network because it was so big. There was a state grand jury and a federal grand jury in Nebraska and also a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C. And I managed to acquire the sealed documentation and testimony of one of the grand juries. And at that point, I was able to really demonstrate how this network functioned and how it existed. And I had the names of approximately 60 victims of this network that had been acquired by an investigator for the Nebraska State Senate. And it was my job to find these kids, these former victims, and get them to talk to me. And I ended up finding a number of them, and their stories were basically the same. A number of those kids came from Boys Town, the heralded orphanage outside of Omaha, Nebraska. It's probably the most famous orphanage in the United States of America. Those kids were really, really in tough shape. They'd come from very dysfunctional lower socioeconomic backgrounds, and they'd been put into Boys Town, and according to them, they'd been trafficked. And other kids that had come forward had said that Boys Town kids had been trafficked. And I found a lot of corroborating information about Boys Town kids being trafficked. That was the beginning for me to write the book. And the book is over 400 pages, and it's very thoroughly documented. And some of the documents that I came across were just so mind-boggling that we had to put them in the book because we didn't think that people would believe them. And the book is thoroughly researched. The corroboration that I have is pretty staggering. I even have flight receipts of the network. Lawrence King rented planes on an almost weekly basis as he flew kids from coast to coast, and I acquired the flight receipts and a myriad of other corroborating information. And I can understand people's skepticism. When I live in New York City, and I've been a writer here for 21 years. I wrote a book proposal, and I gave it to my agent, and my agent called me about 2 weeks later and said that my agent was no longer my agent. So I found another agent who was a good agent, and he tried to sell it, and he couldn't sell the book either. And because with the Franklin scandal, both state and federal authorities said that not a single child had been trafficked. So there wasn't, according to state and federal authorities, there wasn't a crime committed by Lawrence King, that he never trafficked a single child. And despite copious documentation from social services and other agencies. So it was really, really tough to get this book published. And I finally found a small publisher on the West Coast, and they were willing to publish it. I showed them all the evidence that I'd collected over the years, all the sealed grand jury documentation, the sealed grand jury testimony. Other publishers had been very terrified about libel. First of all, this case just was beyond their comprehension, so that was very difficult. But other publishers were very concerned about libel because I was there were very powerful people named by the children and by the victims of this trafficking network. So But the publisher on the West Coast, they had a strong moral code, moral barometer, and they also saw that I had a tremendous amount of documentation, and that I was willing to back up everything that I said in the book. So at that point, they were willing to publish the book. And it's been a dogfight to get the book, to get people to read the book, to get the media to look at the book. I have a lot of friends in the media, and the vast majority of them have not helped me, have not tried to publicize the book at all. So this getting into this area is very difficult. And but what troubled me the most about this, after I'd written the book, no one came after me for libel, and yet no one in the media was willing to take a look at this book. Was willing to, no one was willing to even have me on their show to excoriate me for writing the book. I mean, it was just the mainstream media just ignored this, and I think the mainstream media ignores a lot of stuff. And but for some reason, the Pizzagate has broken through that, and we can talk about that later.
Nick, there's another book titled The Franklin Cover-Up, written by John DeCamp. Would you tell us about that book and the differences with yours?
John DeCamp was a Nebraska state senator, and he wrote a book called The Franklin Cover-Up. And he was very close to this scandal. He lived in Nebraska, and he represented two of the victims. Paul Benassi had been in – there were two kids that refused to recant their abuse. One was Paul Benassi. One was Alicia Owen. And Alicia Owen went on trial for perjury. She was indicted on 8 counts of perjury for refusing to recant her abuse. And she said that the Omaha police chief, Robert Wadman, had repeatedly molested her. She said that the Omaha World Herald publisher, Harold Anderson, had been part of the network and had molested little boys. She also discussed Lawrence King's trafficking of children. And she was indicted on 8 counts of perjury. And when she was indicted, she was 21 years old. She'd been mixed up with this network since she was about 14 years old. And so she was indicted on 8 counts of perjury. And each count of perjury, she was looking at 20 years. So she was potentially looking at 160 years in prison. I mean, a 21-year-old kid was indicted on 8 counts of perjury and was looking at 160 years in prison. And it was up to the state to – she was indicted by a state grand jury on 8 counts of perjury. She was indicted by a federal grand jury on 8 counts of perjury. And it was imperative that she be found guilty of perjury because these grand juries had essentially declared that the Lawrence King's trafficking network was a, quote-unquote, carefully crafted hoax. So ultimately, to sanctify these grand juries – Alicia had to be found guilty, and her criminal trial, at this point she was 22, she'd spent approximately 2 years in solitary confinement too, which was extremely punitive. So her trial was the longest criminal trial in Nebraska state history, and her jury deliberated for 3 days, and she was found guilty of on all counts of perjury. And I dissect that trial. That trial is the biggest chapter in the book, and I show of all the problems about the misconduct by the judge, the misconduct by the prosecution, the misconduct by the jury. All stops were pulled out to make sure that Alicia Owen was, in fact, convicted of perjury. And she was sentenced, and we're talking about a kid here who's 22 years old now, and she was sentenced between 9 and 15 years for perjury. And as I said earlier, she had ultimately did 2 years in solitary confinement. We're talking about a kid here who was sexually abused and refused to recant. Now, what's really interesting is the grand jury, the state grand jury that indicted Alicia on 8 counts of jury and indicted Paul Benassi on 3 counts of grand jury. And Paul Benassi talked about witnessing the police chief molesting Alicia Owen, and he also talked about his firsthand experience being molested by the publisher of the Omaha World Herald. But the judiciary, the Douglas County judiciary, just got Alicia Owen by the skin of its teeth. I mean, that jury deliberated for 3 days. And it should have been deadlocked, but there were a number of, it was manipulated in a number of ways. And as soon as she was found guilty, the perjury charges against Paul Manasseh were immediately dropped. And John DeCamp represented Paul Manasseh at that point. And then through her appellate motions, John DeCamp represented Alicia Owen. So he wrote a book in 1992 called The Franklin Cover-Up, and it was basically from his perspective of what he saw. And I thought that the book was a good start, but that I had time. I didn't start investigating this till 2002, and a lot of things had come out, and I was able to, as I said earlier, to acquire the sealed grand jury documentation and testimony. So, and I was also able to find a number of victims that John DeCamp couldn't find. And so I just felt like that book, like this story needed a very professionally, a professional journalistic rendition because it was something that America needed to know about, these type of networks operating in the United States of America and being covered up. And there's conflicting information about how many children are trafficked in the United States. I mean, the FBI can tell you exactly how many cars go missing in the United States any given year, but they can't tell you exactly or even come close to tell you how many American children go missing. And these type of networks, as I've been involved in this for this type of research and writing about this for 14 years now, I've come across other large networks that have been covered up because of the people that they've pandered children to. And America has to come to the grips with, you know, the fact that American children are being trafficked in America. People don't want to think that American children are being trafficked in America. They want to think that children are being trafficked in the Middle East, and children are being trafficked in Thailand, in Eastern Europe, in Mexico. But according to statistics, 85% of the children that are trafficked in the United States are American children. So that is a huge problem in the United States of American children being trafficked. And I think that the Franklin scandal lays down a template of exactly how children are trafficked, because these traffickers, they acquired runaways. They acquired kids through Boys Town. They acquired kids through the foster care system. I mean, every way that they could acquire children, they acquired children. And the Franklin scandal delineates that of these various victims and how they ended up being trafficked. And until America knows that institutions like Boys Town or the foster care system is vulnerable to trafficking, this problem is going to continue, and it's going to be perpetuated.
So foundations, foster care places, Boys Towns, places like that, will get damaged kids, in essence. But a 12-year-old paper boy in West Des Moines, Iowa, named Johnny Gosch, disappeared in September of 1982 and was presumed to have been kidnapped. Please tell us how this case connects to the Franklin scandal.
Well, in 1982, Johnny Gosch was a paper boy. He was delivering papers in West Des Moines, Iowa, and he was abducted. And the case went cold. Very cold, and there was initially a huge push, and actually Johnny Gosch was one of the first kids to appear on a milk carton, and his case is one of the more famous abductions in the United States. And the Noreen Gosh tried to get information about Johnny Gosh's abduction and
his mother,
and she felt like she was being stonewalled by the police and also by the FBI. And ultimately, one of the Franklin victims came forward in 1990, and he said that he helped abduct Johnny Gosch. And instead of law enforcement actually interviewing him about that, they just completely ignored him. And Paul hooked up with the producers of America's Most Wanted. And he told them where he and Johnny had been taken when they were when Johnny was abducted, and it was a ranch in Colorado. And he said that there was a chamber underneath the ranch where the kids were basically confined. And he took the producers. I mean, the producers of Fox were initially skeptical, but then Paul provided so much information about Johnny's abduction that they started to believe what he had to say. And they followed Paul to this ranch in Colorado, and they found the chamber underneath the house where Paul said that the kids were held and confined. And the producers of America's Most Wanted ultimately ended up believing Paul. And another victim came forward named Jimmy Gibson, who said that he had been confined with Johnny also. And the producers of America's Most Wanted also believed Jimmy Gibson. And so ultimately, Paul Benassi had to be discredited at all counts, because when he came forward, he was part of the victims in Omaha. And all these victims basically said that, you know, they'd been molested by very powerful people. And because there was such a full-court press to keep this covered up, Paul Benassi really could have helped, I believe he could have helped find Johnny Gosch. But because of the cover-up, law enforcement discredited him instead of listening to him. And Johnny Gosch is missing to this very day.
Paul also had some mental health issues. Can you briefly go over that?
I've got Paul Benassi's psychiatric reports, and yes, he suffered from multiple personality disorder, which is caused by extreme trauma at a young age. And according to Paul, he was repeatedly molested at a very, very young age. And so ultimately, he had multiple personality disorder. And law enforcement used that against him to not take him seriously, but his psychiatrist is on record as saying that Paul is perfectly capable of telling the truth, and his psychiatrist believed him when Paul talked about these various traumas. And because of the research that I did on the Franklin scandal, The book ended up with a number of psychiatrists who have dealt with victims of trauma, and these victims have said, I was molested by this senator, I was molested by this parliament member, I was molested by this prime minister. And the psychiatrist had heard these stories for a number of years, and because the system was protecting these politicians, it was very, very difficult for them to get any traction as far as investigations regarding these kids. And a number of these therapists and psychiatrists read my book, because it finally, you know, it was a template for the things that they had encountered over the years regarding child abuse. And they asked me to contribute a chapter in a book of theirs. The book was called Global Perspectives on Dissociative Identity Disorder. And I contributed a chapter to that book, and it was peer-reviewed. And I was very honored to do that, that they asked me to do that.
Noreen Gosh, Johnny's mother, lobbied for the Johnny Gosh bill, state legislation which would mandate an immediate police response to reports of missing children. The bill became law in Iowa in 1984, and similar or identical laws were later passed in Missouri and seven other states. There was another paper boy that disappeared under similar circumstances, Eugene Martin. And somewhere in that documentary, Who Took Johnny, I think it's DeCamp mentions there are two types of kids, the throwaways, street kid types, and then the virgins of high market value. Are these paper boys, are these the high market value, would you say?
According to some sources, yes. A number of these power broker pedophiles don't want children that have been passed around and used and abused repeatedly. They want children that are virgin, quote unquote virgins, and actually it was by that quote came from Paul Sparrow, who was a producer of America's Most Wanted. And according to some sources, these are the children that can potentially pay, that are potentially much more valuable than other children that have been passed around repeatedly, because of how sick some of these pedophiles are, that they want virgin children that haven't been molested before.
Now, getting back into the Franklin scandal, our guest is Nick Bryant, the author of the Franklin scandal. I got a question from a listener who writes, I'd like to know the extent of former CIA Director W.M. Colby's contributions of incriminating intelligence to John DeCamp, author of the Franklin cover-up, during the time shortly before Colby was brutally assassinated in 1996. At the time, I was listening to a lot of talk radio on shortwave, and there were a large group of victims who were ready to identify some and then and current, the top federal officials as having raped them as children.
Well, I talk about William Colby's mysterious death in the Franklin scandal. William Colby was affiliated with Franklin scandal. The Franklin scandal, what happened was social service, people in Nebraska social service had come across repeated reports of Lawrence King flying children around. And these social service personnel had gone to not only the Omaha Police Department, but they'd also gone to the Douglas County Judiciary, and they'd also gone to the federal judiciary in Nebraska. And they were just simply ignored. And ultimately, the Franklin Credit Union came up $40 million short. And with that, the Nebraska State Senate started to investigate how $40 million disappeared from the Franklin Credit Union. And at that point, the social services personnel went to the Nebraska senators and they said, Lawrence King embezzled $40 million, but that's not the full story. The full story is that credit union basically was a front for a child trafficking network. So ultimately, the senators, they kept looking at Lawrence King's financial improprieties, but then they also started digging into his trafficking of children. And that's basically how this whole thing started. Federal law enforcement and state law enforcement had been informed before of Lawrence King's trafficking of children, but they were just completely dismissive and ignored. But once this Nebraska State Senate subcommittee started looking into these allegations, that's when things started to happen in this case. Now, they were looking for an investigator for the subcommittee, and they interviewed William Colby. And William Colby said that he'd be willing to act as an investigator for the subcommittee. But they had heard rumblings that the CIA had been involved with this trafficking network. And so they ultimately decided not to hire William Colby as the subcommittee's investigator. And they hired a local attorney. And John DeCamp, who had been a senator in Nebraska and who had written the earlier book that I talked about, he was friends with Colby. And according to John DeCamp, Colby had been, had done a lot of malevolent things for the CIA. He'd participated in the Phoenix program, which was designed to, basically root out, North Vietnamese in South Vietnamese villages and kill them. And according to the government, up to 20,000 people were killed by the Phoenix program. And he engaged in, and he was also, integral in, when Italy was thinking, was, voting for a communist government to make sure that that didn't happen. And he ultimately became director of the CIA. And during the church hearings, William Colby basically told the U.S. senators about the CIA's mind control program, about how the CIA had infiltrated the media and various assassination programs. And so William Colby was a man that, although he had started out with the OSS and had gone all the way to the top of the CIA, and he'd done a lot of bad things in the name of the CIA, he still had a conscience. Unlike Richard Helms, the former director of the CIA before Colby, who was brought before the Church Commission, and he gave them nothing. So Colby was, you know, felt like the CIA should be accountable to the American people. Now, according to John DeCamp, Colby was born a Catholic and had kind of refound Catholicism. And DeCamp told me that Colby was fairly, that he was all right with everything that he'd done with the CIA except where children were involved. And he wanted to correct that. And he was his death was very, very mysterious. He went canoeing in April, and he wasn't in good health, and he wasn't wearing shoes. And where he went canoeing, his near the Chesapeake Bay, his body wasn't found for 8 days. So, and ultimately, the cover story was that he had a heart attack and he fell out of his canoe. So, but according to DeCamp, Colby had said that he had wanted to do something about the CIA's abuse of children. So, but I leave that open in the book, as, you know, the reader can interpret that how the reader wants. But the death of William Colby is very, very suspicious.
The incriminating intelligence that Colby contributed was the actions of the Larry King. Is it mainly that?
No, William Colby wasn't really talking about Lawrence King in particular, according to John DeCamp, that he was talking about the CIA's role in various mind control programs and how children had been abused in the mind control programs. And I think it's important to remember that that the vast majority of the mind control documentation was destroyed by the CIA. The Church Committee, the senators that were looking into the CIA, wanted the mind control documentation to know exactly what went on with that. And they'd heard that some very sadistic things had occurred with the CIA's mind control experiments, and the vast majority of that was destroyed. I've got some of that documentation in the Franklin scandal. And the documentation does talk about children. One of the documents talks about subjecting children to hypnosis and drugs and electric shock and trying to create dissociative states in children and in other people, because they felt that dissociative states gave people possibly enhance their parapsychological abilities. So the CIA was quite interested in that. And in the document that I have, it's obvious that children were fair game in the CIA mind control experiments.
It's very disturbing, Nick. But we got to talk about this because a lot of people are paying attention to this topic. Gary Caradore, who was the private investigator, had, well, allegedly had something very important in his briefcase that was allegedly in the plane that broke up over a cornfield. That crash site investigation was sealed by the FBI. Gary was a private investigator working on investigating the Federal Credit Union, I believe.
Gary Caradore was hired by the Nebraska State Subcommittee that was looking into the Franklin scandal. And
the credit union specifically?
Into the credit union. And not only the financial malfeasance, but also the child trafficking. And Gary Caradore was a very seasoned investigator. He'd been with the Nebraska State Police, which is called the Nebraska State Patrol, for a number of years, and then he founded his own investigation company, which had over 100 employees. And he was very gifted at finding children that had been abducted and victims that had been abducted and forced into a life of prostitution. So the committee ultimately turned to him to be its investigator after they decided that William Colby wasn't, they decided that they did not want to hire William Colby because of his former ties to the CIA. They were worried about that. And then there was another investigator that members of the Franklin Committee felt wasn't doing an adequate job investigating the child abuse. So ultimately, Gary Caradore was hired, and he went to work immediately finding new victims, and he videotaped them. And in addition to the victims that came forward with social services, Gary Caradore found four additional victims that he videotaped. And he was under a tremendous amount of pressure. The FBI was following him. His phones were tapped. He had been given a number of threats. And according to five sources, and I talk about them in the Franklin scandal, Gary Caradore, he was a private pilot. He flew to Chicago to meet Rusty Nelson. Rusty Nelson had worked as a quote-unquote photographer for Lawrence King. Rusty Nelson was a child pornographer, and I believe he also took blackmail. According to Rusty, he took blackmail pictures for Lawrence King. And Gary Caradore was able to contact Rusty Nelson. Two victims had told Gary Caradore that Rusty Nelson would probably have pictures. One was Alicia Owen, one was Paul Benassi. In fact, I have Alicia on tape saying Gary Caradore interviewed Alicia on tape and asked her where he could possibly find pictures, and Alicia Owen said Rusty Nelson. And according to Paul Benassi, his last conversation with Gary Caradore, Gary asked him where he could find pictures, and Paul had said that Rusty Nelson probably had pictures. So Rusty Nelson, according to Rusty, he was living in the Southwest at that time, and Gary Caradore was able to contact him, and they met in Chicago. Now, I have Rusty Nelson, I have Sandy Caradore, I have Lauren Schmidt, and I have Rusty Nelson, and I have Paul Rodriguez, a newspaper reporter, saying that Rusty Nelson and Gary Caradore, well, I have Sandy Caradore saying that Gary Caradore met Rusty Nelson, and then the others said that Gary Caradore left messages for them saying that he had acquired irrefutable evidence of King's pedophile network. And he was flying back to Nebraska from Chicago, and his plane broke up in midair in a cornfield over Lee County, Illinois. And I get into the various anomalies of that. The FBI the next day impounded all of Gary Caradore's documentation. I mean, they just came to his office with and just impounded everything. And there was, and ultimately the National Transportation Safety Board said that the plane just broke up in midair. Now, most planes just don't break up in midair. So that was very telling. But I also found out that the lab where Gary Caradore's blood should have gone for analysis to see if he'd been drugged or if something had, you know, if he'd ingested something that would have caused problems with the plane, it went to a completely different lab. And I tried to get to the bottom of that, of why it went to a completely different lab, but I could never get to the bottom of that. So ultimately, if Gary Caradore had acquired pictures of Lawrence King's pedophile network, it would have shown that what the kids were saying were true. And I think that the reverberation would have went all the way to Washington, D.C., because a lot, and I haven't gotten into that this yet, but a lot of the kids were flown to Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., there was a party house. It was owned by Craig Spence, who was Lawrence King's partner in crime. And in Craig Spence's house, there was a number of hidden cameras. And he would have all kinds of sex parties at his house. And all kinds of power brokers would be invited, senators, people that were high-ranking in the media, people that were high-ranking in the Reagan administration and in the first Bush administration. They were all invited to Spence's house. And Spence would dangle sexual partners in front of them. If they wanted children, they'd be given children. If they wanted young males, they'd be given young males. If they wanted young women, they'd be given young women. And if they indulged in that house, they were definitely there were definitely pictures taken of them, and they were compromised. The second book that I wrote about this, Confessions of a D.C. Madam, The Politics of Sex, Lies, and Blackmail, Henry Vincent ran an escort service, and he provided gay escorts to Craig Spence. And he witnessed Craig Spence's blackmail equipment firsthand. But there was a lot of reportage on Craig Spence's blackmail equipment. Henry is not the only person that talked about Craig Spence's blackmail equipment. So his house was set up for blackmail. And I think if Gary Caradore had made it back to Omaha alive and shown that he had these pictures that irrefutably proved that Lawrence King had this network, the dominoes would have fallen all the way back to Washington, D.C. And I think that Americans, not only would have Americans realized that their political system is compromised by blackmailed politicians, but that the people that were in some subgenus dark corner of the government that were doing this were also using children. And I think that that would have just sparked an unbelievable amount of outrage. The Franklin scandal had to be covered up at all costs. And Gary Caradore's death isn't the only suspicious death in the Franklin scandal. There are a number of deaths. And I think that if people were aware of this, there would be a tremendous amount of outrage. We saw that with the Sandusky case at Penn State, where Jerry Sandusky had molested kids for a very long time, and had been covered up by Penn State and people within Penn State. But once it came out that all these children had been molested over the years, and that Jerry Sandusky could have been stopped, there was just tremendous outrage. And I think that outrage would have been just completely minimal compared to the outrage of Franklin. So I think that – I think Americans are good people. I think unfortunately the mainstream media has not shared the truth about numerous issues with Americans. And I think if Americans were really aware of these types of networks, that there would be outrage, that there wouldn't be apathy. The Penn State case gives us insight into that.
Nick, you've also written articles about Jerry Sandusky, as you mentioned, but you posted something very interesting about Jeffrey Epstein, and could you tell listeners about that?
I started investigating Jeffrey Epstein about 4 years ago, and Jeffrey Epstein is a very wealthy individual who molested a number of underage girls in Florida, and the a 14-year-old girl told her parents that she'd been molested by Jeffrey Epstein. And Jeffrey Epstein has this big life. He has a large home in, or had a large home in New York City. He's got a palatial place in Palm Beach. He's got a palatial place in New Mexico, and he also owns like one of the smaller Virgin Islands. So, Jeffrey Epstein is a man of tremendous wealth and tremendous power. And the Palm Beach Police Department, when this girl came forward, they were very, they were a little skeptical, but she provided them with the details of Jeffrey Epstein's house. She provided them with details of Jeffrey Epstein's anatomy, and then they started an investigation. And ultimately, the Palm Beach Police Department got four other underage girls to come forward. So they had five, and then they had statements corroborating and affidavits from a number of people corroborating Jeffrey Epstein's use and abuse of children. And ultimately, the Palm Beach Police Department wanted to charge Jeffrey Epstein with five counts of molesting minors, and ultimately the state intervened, and the state said, we're going to have a grand jury investigate this. So with a grand jury, and I've talked a little bit about grand juries earlier, a grand jury is notorious for being susceptible to corruption. There was a New York judge that said special prosecutors have so much power over a grand jury that they could get grand jurors to indict a ham sandwich. And what happens in a grand jury is that the special prosecutor that's chosen shows evidence that he deems is appropriate to the grand jurors. And grand jurors are just people that have shown up they've just shown up for jury duty and they've been funneled into a grand jury. And with the Epstein case, it was very obvious that that special prosecutor just showed those grand jurors evidence that exonerated Jeffrey Epstein from child abuse, because five victims came forward, and there was a number of people that had provided information about Jeffrey Epstein molesting kids. And that grand jury did not indict Jeffrey Epstein on one count of child abuse, not one count. It indicted him on pandering an adult, which was 1 to 5 years. But since then, Jeffrey Epstein has settled over 30 molestation lawsuits regarding underage girls. So, and actually, the feds knew of approximately 35 Jeffrey Epstein victims, and they chose not to act on that information. Ultimately, I ended up with Jeffrey Epstein's black book. And the FBI ultimately impounded it, and I ended up with it. And the Black Book, I published it on Gawker's website. And the Black Book is a who's who of famous people. Not everyone in the Black Book is a pedophile, but there are a number of people that are certainly that certainly took part in Jeffrey Epstein's crimes against children. And what's really interesting about the Black Book is how the FBI got the Black Book. It was the house manager, Jeffrey Epstein's house manager, had taken the Black Book, and he looked at it as a form of protection for him because he knew what Epstein was up to. And he circled names in the Black Book that he had personally witnessed of people taking part in the abuse of minors, or who had witnessed the abuse of minors on some level. And there were a number of very powerful people whose names were circled, including Donald Trump's. And Bill Clinton, Jeffrey Epstein, had over 20 contact numbers for Bill Clinton. And it's since come out that Bill Clinton has spent time on Jeffrey Epstein's private island, Orgy Island. And that's another case where it's very obvious that Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking children, underage girls. And there again, the state let him off, and then the feds came in and said that they were going to exact justice, and they essentially let him off too. He served 13 months in a county jail, and he was allowed to go out during the day. And as I said earlier, he's since settled over 30 molestation lawsuits. And what's kind of interesting about the Jeffrey Epstein case, and not too many people have talked about this, but when the Palm Beach Police Department served their search warrant against Jeffrey Epstein, they found hidden cameras in his home, too. So it's reasonable to surmise that Jeffrey Epstein was also in the blackmail business when it came to the rich and the powerful.
Okay. We have a good background, a real good background here of what these networks look like, the censorship around it, got into a little bit of the funding aspect of it. And now, if we switch gears into what people call Pizzagate and look a little deeper into that, have you had a chance to look at some of the material of Pizzagate? What are your thoughts just on the surface, Nick?
I've looked at some of the material on Pizzagate, and I've got a number of different thoughts on it. I want to start out with... In 2005, there was a gay prostitute who was, moonlighting as a White House correspondent. His name was Jeff Gannon. And he started attending White House press conferences in 2003, and he'd never published an article. The Secret Service was giving him clearances to go to these White House press conferences. He was a gay prostitute. He'd never published a single article. And in 2005, he ostensibly worked for Talon News Service, which was a virtual news service. And in response to a Freedom of Information request by two Democratic representatives, it was found that Gannon, the gay prostitute who moonlighted as a White House press operative, had made over 200 appearances at the White House. And on 14 of those days, he had checked in with the Secret Service, but he'd never checked out. So the Democrats in the House Judiciary Committee wanted an investigation into Gannon, but the committee's Republicans overruled them. So here we have someone who is a gay prostitute who's never written an article in his life, covering press conferences at the White House. And those press credentials are very, very difficult to get. And the reason why I'm getting into Jeff Gannon is in 2005, when this story hit, it came out, there was a lot of internet speculation that Jeff Gannon was Johnny Gosch. Now, we've talked about Johnny Gosch, and it was just overwhelming. And a woman who I know who thinks that my work is very dark and who's very mainstream approached me one day and said, is Jeff Gannon Johnny Gosch? And then another friend of mine who's a journalist was talking to a mainstream editor of a magazine, and the editor asked him, we want to know if Jeff Gannon is Johnny Gosch. So this was making, this was kind of like Pizzagate in a way that it was fomenting and it was coming to the into the zeitgeist. And there was actually a short-lived MSNBC program called Deedle and Daniels that looked into that whether or not Jeff Gann was Johnny Gosch. So, and I was asked to be on that show, but I wasn't, I didn't know whether or not Jeff Gann was Johnny Gosch. So I declined to be interviewed for that show. But what I did is I went down to Washington, D.C., and I found Jeff Gannon. And Jeff Gann was born in 1957, and Johnny Gosch was born in 1969. So just looking at the age differential, I knew that Jeff Gann was not Johnny Gosch. And what's really funny about that, in the Franklin scandal, I tried to – there's a lot of stuff floating around the Internet about – Franklin that is true, and there's a lot of stuff floating around the Internet about Franklin that's false. And when I wrote the Franklin scandal, I tried to address a lot of the false information or disinformation that was floating around with this story, because I really wanted the truth, and I wanted to debunk a lot of the stuff on the Internet that I found to be false. There were a number of false things on the Internet. And so I wrote the book, and it's exhaustively researched. And towards the end of the book, I talk about Johnny Gosch and how had the FBI listened to Paul Benassi, they probably could have found Johnny Gosch. And I also talk about the various bits of evidence that I acquired that linked Johnny Gosch to Paul Benassi. When Paul Benassi was in prison, kids were writing him and talking about JG, and, you know, obviously these kids had been part of the same network and had broken away. So I talk about that. I talk about Paul Benassi and Johnny Gosch, and in the book I say that I looked into it, and Johnny Gosch is not Jeff Gannon. And then I've given a number of interviews about for the Franklin scandal since the book has come out, innumerable interviews. And I still get asked, is Jeff Gannon Johnny Gosch? I mean, it's had that much power on the Internet that it still, you know, it still creeps up. And the people that ask me this question obviously haven't read my book, which is a little troubling, but I found that most radio hosts, except for Jeff and others, a few others, actually read books before they talk to you about them. So, but that is one of the instances where, you know, here is something that was very, that was propagated very, very intensely on the Internet. And ultimately it was false. It just took me driving from New York City to Washington, D.C., and finding Jeff Gannon and realizing that there was too much of an age differential for Jeff Gannon to be Johnny Gosch. So what I've seen with Pizzagate is a similar kind of Internet frenzy. And I don't, I'm very skeptical of what the mainstream media reports. I mean, I'm just after I, you know, Franklin has taught me a lot of things. And I was skeptical of the mainstream media before Franklin, but after I got into Franklin, I became very skeptical. And, but I wanna lead with a quote here. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. So as a journalist and just as a human, I try not to have contempt prior to investigation. I try to look into everything. I've been looking at what Pizzagate, people have said about Pizzagate, and I've tried to take it in. I see a couple of problems with the research of Pizzagate. The people that are promulgating Pizzagate are using a lot of information about the Franklin scandal that I've shown was false, which kind of troubles me a little bit because
specifically what, Nick?
They're using information by Ted Gunderson, who was a FBI agent, and I think that Ted was either deluded or he participated in disinformation or maybe both. And they're using information that he brought to the table. And I became very skeptical of Ted Gunderson early on in my Franklin investigation. And there are also a number of these researchers are talking about John DeCamps to cover the Franklin cover-up. And as I said earlier, John DeCamps' book was a good start, but my book came in with a lot more information. And so that kind of troubles me, not because people aren't buying my book or, I mean, my book sales have gone up. The Franklin scandal is certainly selling more than it had previously. But that that there's other information out there about these types of networks that people aren't utilizing. And there is what I've seen with I mean, Tony Podesta's art, I mean, some of it is very, very strange. And but like there's the Arch of Hysteria that's been shown a number of times. It was created by Louise Bourgeois. She was an artist that died, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. And
Arch of Agony.
Arch of Agony, yes. And I've looked into her, and she and people are using that, and there also there was a picture that was recovered from Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment that that had a body in a similar pose. Now, I've done a lot of research into Bourgeois, and I have come to the conclusion, and I've talked to a number of people in the art world about this, and I've come to the conclusion that there was nothing that Jeffrey Dahmer did that affected Bourgeois' art whatsoever. So, in that respect, you know, I'm a little skeptical. And I've got a friend named Peter Lavenda, who's written a number of books on the occult and on parapolitics, who had his picture was taken with John Podesta, and he's come under the crossfire. I mean, he's been the recipient of character assassination. And I was just in Florida last week, and I met with Peter. We had lunch, and I've known Peter for a number of years. And he was chagrined that that he had come up and that people were mentioning him along with Pizzagate. So the mainstream media wants to tell us that Pizzagate is nothing. And granted, there's no victims have been found yet of the people. I mean, there's some very strange things about the Instagram account with James Elefantis, about, you know, some of the pictures that were in the Instagram account that have since that are since inaccessible. But I would say to researchers, proceed with caution, because it's really difficult to know whether or not there's a reality there. And what I was saying earlier about when I talked about Johnny Gosch as Jeff Gannon and how that story just kind of exploded and proliferated and and ultimately you know, I found it to be extraneous. So basically, you've got Jeff Gannon, who's going into the White House. And when I wrote Henry Vincent's book, Confessions of a DC Madam, Henry was debriefed by the Secret Service in 1990, and they asked him about Jeff Gannon. So Jeff Gannon had been a male prostitute, and I believe Henry on this. And Henry had known Jeff Gannon, so in 1990 and earlier, and Jeff Gannon said that he spent nights in the White House, and Henry was in a weird world of gay escorts, and he didn't know whether or not to believe Jeff Gannon or not to believe him. But according to Henry, the Secret Service was aware of Jeff Gannon in 1990. So So the Secret Service was aware of Jeff Gannon being a male prostitute in 1990, and yet he's showing up in these press conferences in 2003 and going all the way to 2005. So the Johnny Gosch aspect of this could have obfuscated the reality that, you know, what is this gay prostitute doing in these press conferences? And some days he's signing into the White House and some days he's not. And
some would say that would be a national security issue.
Some would say that would be a national security issue for sure. And so what we have with Jeff Gannon as Johnny Gosch is a tremendous obfuscation of something that I think was heavily covered up, that wasn't reported by the mainstream media. The mainstream media should have really gotten to the bottom of that. You know, why is a gay escort who hasn't written a word, why is he being allowed into the White House? And so it took on a life of its own. So with Pizzagate, I see a lot of people sitting at their computers making connections here and making connections there and coming across weirdness here and coming across weirdness there. But I'm not willing to sanctify that. It's that it is, in fact, a network. Jeff is the only one that I've granted an interview to about this, and because other people that have approached me and wanted interviews wanted me to sanctify the reality of Pizzagate, and I was completely unwilling to do that at this point. I think that there is a place for citizen journalism, and I think that today, investigative journalism has been lost. I mean, most mainstream media really don't have the resources for investigative journalism like they used to. And investigative journalism has come down to citizens and the internet. And it's a very good thing that we have the internet. But I'm behind citizen investigations. I think that is where ultimately we're going to start getting truth. But I think with Johnny Gosch's Jeff Gannon and Pizzagate, we're running into similar issues of extraneous things that or erroneous things have been blown up into a reality that they're not. And
Nick, let me jump in for a minute and ask you, what would you say to citizen journalists in terms of how to cover an issue like Pizzagate? What would you suggest in terms of approaches? And by the way, there are two questions on your phone.
Okay. Well, it's really important in investigating something like this. It's really important to find victims. I mean, that was the biggest difficulty I had with the Franklin scandal, was finding victims. I had a list of 60 victims.
And how many did you ultimately find out of that list?
I found 12, and I got most of them to talk to me. And it's really difficult to find victims of child abuse, of especially networks like this. A lot of these kids came from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, and they were turned on to drugs, they were turned on to alcohol, they were repeatedly molested, and then when they reached a point where they were no longer marketable, where they lost their youthful marketability, then they were just expunged like gum that's lost its flavor. They were just discarded. And then they went on to commit crimes because they were drug addicts. Most of them became drug addicts. They were hooked on drugs. And so with the Franklin scandal, the hardest part of that was to find victims. And I found victims in projects. I found a victim in a homeless shelter. I looked for a victim in a crack house. I found a victim in prison. And most of these kids were living very, very marginal lives, or most of these victims were living very, very marginal lives. And that's what's missing in this Pizzagate it's incumbent upon citizen journalists to find victims at this point. And victims, and in my experience, getting victims to comment and to go on the record is very, very difficult because we also saw this with Jeffrey Epstein too. These victims have been with very powerful men, and ultimately, they're frightened and they're told, you know, if you come forward, a number of the victims that I've talked to, you know, were told, if you come forward, you know, not only are you going to put your life at risk, but you're going to put the lives of your family at risk. So it's very, very difficult to get these victims to come forward. And I spent a number of years, you know, finding victims and getting them to come forward. And sometimes it took years to cultivate relationships with victims where they trusted me enough so that they would come forward and grant me an interview. And I should also mention that if you read the Franklin scandal, I had a couple of members of federal law enforcement come forward and give me information.
On the record.
On the record. And now I did not use their names, and the deal was that I would not use their names. But if they would have been caught giving me information, that would have been the end of their careers. I mean, that would have been the end of their house payments, their car payments, their children's college. So, there's a lot of information floating around, but, you know, the devil is in the details. And cultivating relationships with victims is very important. Cultivating relationships with people in law enforcement are very important to get them to come forward. And with Pizzagate, we have not seen that yet. And there's a lot of conjecture. There's a lot of coincidences. There's some, you know, extreme weirdness on the part of Tony Podesta and Alfontas, but we haven't uncovered victims yet. So that would be an important starting point in a Pizzagate investigation.
Well, we're gonna take your questions on Pizzagate, the Franklin scandal. If you have a question. Got a question. A couple questions here. Were women involved in child molestation in the Franklin scandal, and why weren't the child victims simply murdered to keep them silent?
There were people that were murdered in the Franklin scandal. As I mentioned earlier, Gary Caradore was murdered. There were people that were involved with with Lawrence King that were murdered, and I believe that there were victims that were murdered. But there were scores of children that were ultimately abused in the Franklin scandal, that were ultimately trafficked in the Franklin scandal, scores of children. I had a list of 60, but I knew that there were many, many, many more. And you can't kill all those kids. I mean, but what you can do if you kill one of them, or if you kill two of them, or the special investigator that's trying to uncover the Franklin scandal, his plane blows up mysteriously. That will silence people. There's a Chinese proverb, kill one man, silence a thousand. And that definitely applies to these types of investigations with powerful people.
And were there women involved?
And yes, a number of the women, mostly King pandered underage boys, but Alicia Owen, the girl that got 9 to 15 years for perjury, and actually Eulise Washington, the first girl to come forward, she had been abused too. There were other girls that had been abused by these people. It's kind of interesting. In the Franklin scandal, Lawrence King was primarily pandering to Republicans who liked little boys, and with Jeffrey Epstein, he was primarily pandering underage girls to Democrats. So
that seems to be where there's a partisan split in our politics, is that that Democrats that are inclined to be pedophilic like little girls and Republicans that are inclined to be pedophilic like little boys. That's what I've noticed in my investigation. But, yes, there were definitely girls that were trafficked in the Franklin scandal.
Another question I got was, do you see any possibility that anyone in the right positions, FBI or CIA, would break rank and truly investigate these networks because anyone who gets too close will be silenced?
As I said earlier, a couple of members of federal law enforcement gave me an interview, gave me great information. I mean, they were hugely helpful. It took me 2 years to cultivate a relationship with those people. It took me 2 years because they had to be 100% certain that if I took heat, that I wasn't going to give them up. And it took me 2 years before they felt comfortable enough so that they could give me information and they didn't feel like I was going to give them up. And I also talked about earlier that I acquired the sealed grand jury and sealed documents of the grand jury. And it took 4 years for that. It took 4 years. The people that gave me that sealed documentation, that was illegal for them to do. They potentially could have been thrown into prison for giving me that documentation. So they had to be 100% comfortable with me that I wasn't going to give them up.
What about you? Are you in danger of having those documents?
Well, I have those documents, and those documents are disseminated all over. One thing that I started to do, I had a connection in intelligence who told me when I first started digging into this, he said, disseminate all your documentation. Disseminate all your interviews. And what I did with my interviews is I put them on CDs, and then I just gave them to people, people that I trusted. And then what I did with the grand jury documentation is I put them on PDF files, and I disseminated them all over. So, and yes, ever since the Franklin scandal has been published, I could have been arrested. I mean, I quote from grand jury testimony, which was illegal for me to do. But I feel like what happened with the Franklin scandal was such an egregious miscarriage of justice that I'd be willing to eat 18 months for contempt of court. I mean, they would put me before a judge or a magistrate. The magistrate would say, where'd you get it? And I'd say, I respectfully decline to tell you. And they'd give me 18 months. I mean, that wouldn't bother me. But the government does not want to publicize my book at all. So, I don't really fear, arrest for publishing sealed grand jury testimony. Although other journalists have, in fact, been incarcerated for publishing sealed grand jury testimony. I don't think it's going to happen to me.
We have a question here in the audience. Basically, the person asked, are there women abusers, and how is WikiLeaks involved in Pizzagate? And Nick, you mentioned that the FBI database has problems. Would it be easier to go local to posh neighborhoods and start to investigate missing children in those types of neighborhoods?
According to my research, there are women that abuse minors, and there's certainly been a number of cases of that that have been unearthed. But it seems to be that the vast majority of child abusers are men. How is WikiLeaks involved? Well, it's really difficult to know exactly. I mean, WikiLeaks released the emails that have the Podesta emails that have the strange codes on them that no one seems to crack. I mean, we're surmising and extrapolating what we think that those codes are, but no one really knows exactly for sure.
You're not familiar with those codes?
No, I'm familiar with them, but do we know exactly what they mean?
Have you seen them before?
Yes. No, I have not. I have not seen those codes before. So, And as far as the FBI goes, the National Center on Missing and Exploited Children, which works with the FBI, I've talked to them before, and they seem to be completely obtuse to a number of the problems that are involved with child trafficking. I've tried to explain, and I've tried to explain to various anti-trafficking organizations the extent of Franklin, but they don't really want to listen to me. And I think I'm surmising this, that one of the reasons is that they get a lot of money from the government. They get grants from the government to perpetuate themselves. And organizations only seek to, you know, at a certain point, seek to perpetuate themselves. And so the information that I have about the government covering up networks like Franklin or networks like Epstein, they're not going to take me very seriously, because they're going to, that would, if they did in fact take me seriously, that would jeopardize their funding. So that's one of the problems that I've encountered.
What
organization is that? What group is that? The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, I've talked to, along with a number of the larger anti-trafficking organizations. And they throw out the number, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children throws out the number that 100,000 American children are trafficked annually. And they can't even tell you how they derive that number. I mean, that number is just a guess on their part. And they've recently been called out on that and basically said that, and they're going to stop using that number. So, and that's supposed to be the organization that knows about how many, should have an idea of how many children are getting trafficked, along with the FBI. But here are two organizations that Americans look to give us an idea of the trafficking problem in the United States of America, and they don't have a clue. They can't help us out at all with that. So that's a real problem. That's we have to, you know, if we're going to really get a handle on child trafficking in the United States of America, we're going to have some organizations that provide us with, you know, good information. As long as these organizations are unwilling to provide us with, you know, reasonable information or information that they can back up, we're in a lot of trouble as far as fighting trafficking in the United States. A person from the audience asked us about children who are with protective mothers, who the courts ultimately give to abusive fathers who have a history of sexual abuse and or trafficking. And I've seen that occur in a number of cases where women have contacted me and said, the court has awarded my child or children to their father who has a history of sexual abuse. And actually, a number of women have approached me about that, and it's really tough for me because I'm just one guy writing about this, and it's tough for me to get my message out there. But that happens, and you can see it in the Franklin scandal. As I said earlier, the Franklin scandal offers a template for different types of trafficking and how children are acquired, and how trafficking networks are covered up. And you can see in the Franklin scandal that the first girl that came forward was Eulise Washington, and she said that Lawrence King had flown her to trips to Chicago and also to New York City, where she had been pandered, and that she'd attended, like, pedophilic orgies. And ultimately what happened with that was the courts completely ignored what Eulise Washington was saying, what her guardian ad litem was saying, and they sided with the parents who had a tremendous track record for child abuse and who had abused these children. So that occurs quite often. Yes.
The questions about Child Protective Services.
Right.
Right. They knew about the information. They knew about the molestation. They knew about Larry King.
What happened there is they went to state and federal law enforcement. They went to state and federal law enforcement repeatedly, and they were just simply ignored by state and federal law enforcement. Those allegations didn't come to the fore until the Franklin Committee was formed, that Senate subcommittee that was looking into Lawrence King's embezzlement of $40 million from the Franklin Credit Union. So in that situation, Social Services, Child Protective Services was trying to do the right thing, but law enforcement just completely ignored them. And so there again, you've got a situation where law enforcement is covering up child abuse, and that cover-up continued all the way through the conviction of Alicia Owen for perjury.
A listener called in and wanted you to elaborate on Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump.
Okay, Jeffrey Epstein has known Donald Trump for a number of years, and it's kind of interesting. Donald Trump has given a couple of quotes that, yeah, Jeffrey's a great guy, he's a good friend of mine. And when Jeffrey Epstein's shadow life started emerging, Donald Trump, and this is kind of interesting, when Jeffrey Epstein's shadow life started emerging, Donald Trump distanced himself from Jeffrey Epstein. And in one of the Gawker articles that I wrote, Donald Trump said that he knew Jeffrey Epstein through his Mar-a-Lago club in Florida, and he said that he had never been to Jeffrey Epstein's home. Since then, at that time, I did not have information about Donald Trump being at Jeffrey Epstein's home. But since then, I've got irrefutable information that Donald Trump has been to Jeffrey Epstein's home. So in that Gawker article that I wrote, Donald Trump lied about not being at Jeffrey Epstein's home. So that would be something that investigative journalists and also citizens who have taken on this Pizzagate could look into the links between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. What happened in that case was the victim, I did a lot of research on that case. The victim said that she was molested as a 13-year-old by Donald Trump. And a woman came forward and also submitted an affidavit with the plaintiff's affidavit, and her name is Tiffany Doe. So Jane Doe submitted the affidavit saying that she was molested by Donald Trump when she was 13, and Tiffany Doe submitted an affidavit too. Tiffany Doe had been a stripper at Scores, and she said that's where she originally met Jeffrey Epstein, was at Scores, and that Jeffrey Epstein got her to bring strippers to his parties. And according to her, Jeffrey Epstein started grooming her for younger and younger and younger girls to molest, and she said that she met Jane Doe at Port Authority and brought her to Jeffrey Epstein's parties. Now, she filed that case. Unfortunately, that case got involved with someone named Al Taylor, who worked for Jerry Springer, who is not a paragon of journalistic ethics, and he brought it to the fore. And Al Taylor and Truth are somewhat estranged. So Al Taylor is not the best person to be ushering Tiffany Doe's allegations to the fore, but an attorney in Princeton, New Jersey met with Tiffany Doe and met with Jane Doe and felt that she was telling the truth. And then he got a co-counsel in Florida, a pretty big-time lawyer named Cheney Mason, who met with Tiffany Doe and felt that she was telling the truth. And I've met with someone else who's met with Tiffany Doe, said she's telling the truth, and then Lisa Bloom, who represents a number of victims, who is the daughter of Gloria Allred, who also represents another victims, got involved, and she met with Jane Doe and felt she was telling the truth. Now, what happened there, according to my sources, and they could be wrong or they could be right, I don't know. Lisa Bloom picked up Jane Doe. She was at a hotel in Los Angeles and told her that morning that she was going to be in a press conference. She was not primed for the press conference, and she ultimately decided not to do the press conference. And then, and I guess she'd had some death threats too. And ultimately, she told her attorney that she wanted to withdraw from the case, and the attorney immediately withdrew from the case. So, so that's where it stands now, is that the case has been withdrawn. It's difficult to know because you had that gentleman, Al Taylor, involved in this, and he was trying to get as much money as he possibly could. And Tiffany Doe did corroborate Jane Doe, and there was going to be a hearing last month, but because Jane Doe told her attorney to withdraw the case, it's been withdrawn, and that's where we're at now.
It's pretty difficult for victims coming forward again. Back to the Franklin scandal for a moment. Got a question. Whatever happened to Larry King? Is he still alive? What happened to his network? Did he serve the full 15 years?
No, Lawrence King did about 10 years in prison, not for sexual crimes, but for embezzling money from the Franklin Credit Union. He ended up in what federal prisoners call Club Fed, which is the Rochester Psychiatric Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota. And you've got a number of high-profile criminals that end up there. Jim Baker ended up there. Lyndon LaRouche ended up there. Joey Iupa, the head of the Chicago Mafia, ended up there. So... And it's as far as federal prisons go, if you're going to go to a federal prison, it's not quite the Marriott, but it's not too bad. So he did 10 years for that, and he's basically has a no-show job at a BMW dealership in Alexandria, Virginia. So he's been taken care of very well since then. He did his 10 years, kept his mouth shut. Now his partner Craig Spence was kind of a loaded gun, and he was a crack addict, and he had a hard time keeping his mouth shut, and he committed suicide, and I talk about his suicide in my book, in the Franklin Scandal, and I also talk about his suicide in Confessions of a DC Madam. And his suicide was very strange. I think that he did, in fact, kill himself. There's conjecture on the internet that he was suicided, but I disagree with that. I think that he was basically given a choice of suicide or a pretty horrible life. All his money was gone, and he could no longer be used as an asset. And I think that he went to the Ritz-Carlton in Boston and overdosed. He dressed himself up in a tuxedo and was listening to Mozart while he overdosed, and left behind a couple of things that were kind of interesting. But you can read about that in either the Franklin Scandal or Confessions of a DC Man.
Hi, thank you. Before you break off today, I think this is a story and an investigation that should be ongoing. I commend Jeff Brady for putting this on the station. Before you break off here today, maybe you can also tell the audience, the listening audience, and us here in the audience, how we can do small things and then get information to you or some other organizing thing to happen, because it seems like law enforcement at the high levels is not doing anything about this, and also is kind of like misinformation is going around and all of that, debunking. So Oh, so there's that. So what can we do in small ways around in little towns, maybe to get you some information back to you, possibly, then furthering that? And then also, have you experienced any Psy war about this? Anything in movies or in the media that kind of passively debunks this kind of stuff? Because there is a movie coming out called Split, and it's a man abducts about three 18-year-old women in a car in a parking lot in a mall and then goes from there. And he's supposed to be based on a possible true story of a split personality person. So I take that as, oh, only crazy people do this, you know, that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
Well, there's a number of things that people can do. When you have a disease, if you're an individual, you have a disease like cancer, and I think that child trafficking is a cancer within our society. The first thing that you need is awareness. And once you're aware of the disease, then you need to accept it. And then after you've accepted it, then you need action. And I think that where our society is at right now is we have a very limited awareness of the trouble, of the problem of this child trafficking cancer. And we have very little acceptance of this child trafficking cancer. And I think a really important step for people to really understand this problem, I think they really need to read the Franklin scandal, because there isn't another book out there like it that really delineates the child trafficking network in the United States of America. And once someone understands the Franklin scandal, because what makes the Franklin scandal such a rich milieu for understanding this problem is Lawrence King was getting kids from everywhere. He was getting kids, as I said earlier, he was getting runaways that had fallen through the cracks. He was getting kids from orphanages, and he was getting kids from foster care. I mean, he was getting kids from everywhere. And also with the Franklin scandal, you see child trafficking covered up not by social services, but never getting outside social services. You see child trafficking covered up by local law enforcement and the judiciary, and you also see child trafficking covered up by federal law enforcement and the federal judiciary. So it's really important to understand the scope of the problem and how these predators work in these larger networks. And I think that people have to have awareness and acceptance before they can make prudent actions, and or else you're just going to be spinning around and spinning around and spinning around. And that's a very good point. And I think that once there is this awareness and acceptance of the problem, then we can, form organizations that can take proper actions. And it's really going to be a battle, because the mainstream media is so reluctant to embrace this type of a conspiracy. And from my research in Franklin and in other networks, there are people that are very high placed in the mainstream media that took part certainly with King and Spence, and I think Epstein also. So you have people that are personnel that are very high ranking in the mainstream media that are part of these networks, that are exploited by these networks, that are blackmailed by these networks, and then there's also people don't want to jeopardize their livelihoods. They might not be, and you saw this in, you see this in the Franklin scandal, Two, where people aren't necessarily compromised or blackmailed, but they don't want to jeopardize their livelihoods. So they're going to go along with this, whether they're U.S. attorneys or prosecutors. And what's really fascinating about the Franklin scandal is one of the Douglas County prosecutors, the Douglas County attorney that prosecuted Alicia, he became an Omaha judge. The other Douglas County prosecutor that prosecuted Alicia Owen, he became an assistant U.S. attorney. Now, there was a U.S. magistrate that aided and abetted this cover-up. And actually, he put Kay in a mental institution. As soon as the Franklin Committee was getting wise to Kay and what was happening there because of Gary Caradore, this magistrate just had King deposited in a federal mental institution, and he's now a U.S. judge. And then there was an assistant U.S. attorney named Thomas Tolkien who prosecuted Alicia at the federal level, and he's now a U.S. magistrate. So you see in this story with the Franklin scandal that that the officers of the court that participated in this cover-up, they got bumped up the totem pole. And one of them is now a U.S. District Court judge with a lifetime appointment.
It's really important to understand that aspect of it. And so the researchers and citizen journalists know what they're up against and understand the anatomy of a cover-up. That's what these 2 hours are about here on WBAI in the middle of the afternoon. That's why we're talking about this in the context of the citizen journalism going on amid the Pizzagate scandal. There was a censorship within the documentary The Conspiracy of Silence that was produced back in 1993. Shortly before it was to air, the first Tuesday screening, the Discovery Channel inexplicably withdrew its support. Nick Bryant, who has two questions on his phone, I don't know if we're going to get to those, Nick, was talking also about Wikipedia censoring information on the Franklin scandal, and we were going to get into that if we have time. We have just a couple minutes here. Do you have time for one more question from the listener?
Yeah, I'd just like to say there's a documentary out now on Netflix called Who Took Johnny about the Johnny Gosch abduction, and I was an associate producer on that documentary, and it's a lot of people have. It's really opened the eyes of a lot of people. And if you want to see real palpable evidence of child trafficking and a cover up, I would suggest that you look at Netflix. Who Took Johnny? It's a very enlightening documentary.
And don't let Stephen Colbert tell you not to watch it, and because he's admonishing anyone who looks into Pizzagate, because he says there's nothing to see. It's fake. But if you notice, Colbert doesn't go into 1 ounce of evidence supporting the view that what's known as Pizzagate is fake. They don't describe how it's a false story. Meanwhile, there's mountains of possible evidence here of a child pedophile network. But remember what Nick Bryant said about we need victims coming forward. But also, it's a similar tactic used against Dr. Judy Wood, author of Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. It's a similar tactic used when the topic of geoengineering is talked about publicly. Despite the hard evidence of Senate hearings discussing the topic, published reports worldwide that the technology exists. You can go down the list. There's an organization, Nick, called the Child Lures Prevention, founded by Ken Wooden. Would you suggest listeners go to that and if there are cases they know about of missing children?
I am not familiar with that organization, so I would have to do some research on it before I gave it my imprimatur, but that's, we do need more organizations like that to spring up.
Do you know of any that you would suggest to listeners?
To tell you the truth, I've looked in, as I said earlier, I've gone to a number of these anti-trafficking agencies, and I've been very disappointed with the type of knowledge that the people have. They have a tendency to, and this gets back into awareness and acceptance. These organizations have a tendency to look at child trafficking from about 5,000 feet. They don't come down into the problem. And when I see organizations that are going to Thailand or Mexico to fight child trafficking, you know, I applaud that because child trafficking is a horrific, horrific thing, and it needs to be stopped wherever. But these are American organizations going to Mexico and going to Thailand and going to Eastern Europe and to combat trafficking. I mean, they should come here to the United States of America. And I mean, we have this problem in our own backyard, and we need to get a handle on it before we start going to Thailand or Mexico or Eastern Europe. Again, anybody that's fighting child trafficking, I applaud that, but the problem is here now in the United States of America, and that's what we have to take care of at this point.
I don't know if we're going to have time to cover this, but you talked about the False Memories Syndrome Foundation in the context of witnesses coming forward alleging sexual abuse. It's founded by four people, and this is not really helping the witnesses.
Well, this is kind of interesting. The False Memory Syndrome Foundation was founded in the 90s by Pamela and Peter Fried, and they've had a tremendous amount of weight as far as they've had a tremendous amount of impact on the media. And actually, Frontline has done two segments that have pertained to the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. But Peter Fried is an alleged child molester of his own daughter. And people in that family know that Peter Fried is guilty of molesting his daughter. And Ralph Underwager, who is one of the other founders, is on record as saying that pedophilia is God's will. And and also saying that women that were molested felt that the experience was good for them when they became adults. So so this is the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and it's a very, very corrupt organization. And but the media has given it free rein. I mean, I'm amazed at the laudatory articles that have been written about the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. But one of the doctors, psychiatrists that was affiliated with the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, testified against a Boys Town kid who had been molested by Father James Kelly, who was a notorious pedophile who's molested kids all over the country. And so there's mechanisms like this that protect child molesters, unfortunately. And the False Memory Syndrome Foundation is something that citizen journalists should really look into. If they want to understand child abuse and how people get away with child abuse, citizen journalists should look at the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. It's a house of cards. It comes apart pretty quickly.
Well, that's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. A special thanks to Melissa and the staff here at Brooklyn Commons and those here attending the event. Thank you very much for being present. And the listeners of WBAI, thank you very much. Thanks to Berthold Reimers and Tony Bates and Tony Ryan, the engineer. And lastly, big thank you to Nick Bryant for the courageous journalism. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you again for the support of this live event. A big thank you to Sandra Ramos with Strengthen Our Sisters in New Jersey, strengthenoursisters.com. She also made it out. I want to add a short piece here from a past interview with Dr. Lori Handrahan. WBAI and In Other News had reported on this in depth back in 2012, but as you've heard, it usually falls flat. Maybe that's changing. The guest was Dr. Lori Handrahan. The topic, government workers and child pornography.
A few months ago, author and investigative journalist Nick Bryant joined us live in the studio to talk more about his book, The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal. Among many revelations, the book exposed the anatomy of a cover-up and the funding structure of child sex trafficking rings. Today we talk with Dr. Lori Handrahan, who has written many articles about child trafficking in the United States, including one titled The Justice Department's Child Porn Problem. We continue the discussion on investigating child pornography and sex trafficking within the U.S. government, local, state, and federal. It was only a few years ago that Dr. Handrahan's daughter was involved in a nightmare altercation in connection with the state of Maine, sex trafficking, and major court battles. We learn more about Dr. Handrahan's research, and she says there needs to be not only justice for the children involved, but IRS accountability of the billions of dollars pouring through these black industries. Dr. Lori Handrahan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have you on, although the topic is really painful to discuss, but we have to look at this. We have to examine it, and very few people have the stomach to do so. But you have a connection to this child trafficking. If you could tell the listeners a little bit about your story before we get into your research, that would be a good place to start.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. My daughter will be 6 at the end of November, and I have not seen her since last May 10th. Although I had joint custody, her father, who's actually a criminal alien from former Yugoslavia, he's not legal in this country, and his lawyer, Michael Waxman, who have trafficked her, criminally withheld her from me for over a year and a half in contempt of joint custody. And then the judge rewarded them with giving them sole custody and tried me in absentia. So she's been trafficked from me by her father and his lawyer, Michael Waxman. Michael Waxman's family owns a real estate company called Finard Properties, which is a vast corporate real estate holding. They have properties from Tennessee all the way up to Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire. Their corporate base is Boston, and they own, as far as I can tell, about half the state of Maine. They own, or they did at one point, Central Maine Power, shopping malls, Marriott's, Hyatt's. And Michael Waxman put in an email at the very beginning of this when I had sole custody of my daughter, that he was going to use his vast family fortune to take my daughter from me. Those were not his exact words, but that was the gist of the email.
For listeners to get a better picture, how long ago was this?
Well, this all started when I left her. Her father had told me that he had been tortured during the Balkan War, and I was the UNHCR representative out in the Balkans when I met her father. He had a Dutch passport, so I didn't trigger that this may have been a green card thing for him. It turned out, you know, everything he told me was a lie. Basically, he played me for a green card. But soon after the green card was filed in America, we were married, he was arrested and pled guilty to domestic violence and domestic assault on me and the baby, which is a deportable offense. It was on a temporary green card. He'd only had the green card for about 5 months at that point. And then I left him after about a year and a half because of his violence. And I finally said, you know, I'm really sorry if you were tortured, but I'm not going to have my daughter raised this way.
Could you tell listeners what happened to your daughter?
Yeah, when I left him, we had 2 live protection orders for abuse for me and her, which are also deportable offenses, and these were all on a temporary card. He then hooked up with this man named Michael Waxman, who's phenomenally wealthy, who's been representing him for free, and I believe that there's been access traded for my daughter. She was substantiated for rape by her father. She came home. He eventually got to start to see her. They switched judges from a good judge to Jeff Moskowitz, who's been very openly working with Michael Waxman, and I believe is part of this pedophile ring in the state of Maine, who's been trafficking children for a very long time. She came home with a shredded vagina, screaming when she peed because it hurts when your vagina is cut, talking about her father was poking her in the vagina with his penis, and she wanted him to stop. She had blood and skin cells in her urine. She was substantiated for sex abuse by the Spurwink Sex Abuse Clinic, which is one of the top in the country and the best in Maine, the gold standards. 2 doctors had medical records, had seen her inflamed vagina. She had a urinary tract infection, which is another indicator of sex abuse. And she gave a clean forensic interview to the examiners at Spurwink in non-leading questions. That's all up on the web. We put the transcript up where she talked about her father's poking her in the vagina with his penis and I managed to get a hidden recording of her telling her cat. And they testified for about 6 hours before Judge Moskowitz that it was one of the strongest cases of child sex abuse they'd ever seen in the state of Maine. There was no doubt that she had been sexually abused by her father, and they recommended supervised contact only, strongly recommended. And Jeff Moskowitz, the judge who's been working with Michael Waxman, said there was no evidence that she'd been sexually abused and ordered overnights with her father immediately.
So you would say that the evidence here has been completely ignored in the courts?
No, it's like Soviet. I mean, actually, I think in the Soviet Union they actually had more of a veneer of justice than they've had in Jeff Moskowitz's court in the state of Maine. And Donald Alexander is the other judge who's heavily involved in this pedophile ring in the state of Maine. And what's interesting is, in the state of Maine now, it's just come out, there is a John's list of about 170 names of police, clergy, lawyers, politicians, judges, apparently, that the Maine State Police are withholding. And the only thing they've said is that all the people on the John's list should get defense lawyers. And the police have said it's a complicated case because child protection had to get involved. So the Seacoast Online has been the only one really reporting this. There have been a few reports in Maine, but outside of Maine and New Hampshire, Seacoast has been reporting this. And that's the ring. It was a very steep learning curve for me because I assumed that in America, when you have evidence of child sex abuse, child protection and the police would get involved. And what I didn't understand that when the police are so heavily involved in the child porn industry and child protection is so heavily involved in the child trafficking for that child porn, they're not going to help you when you call them.
That's true. And that relates to Nick Bryant's book,
yes,
The Franklin Scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about parallels about that book and your experience. But if you could just give listeners a brief description of your background.
Sure. For more than 20 years, I have done women's rights and children's rights in Central Asia, Mongolia, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan. I do sexual gender-based violence, so rape as a weapon of war. I was the first gender advisor for the UN Agency for Refugees, UNHCR, in Chad, Darfur at the beginning of the genocide, 140 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, 6 to 6 out in the camps all day long, working with women who were severely traumatized from rape and gang rape in the genocide. I have a PhD from the London School of Economics. I don't even have a speeding ticket to my name. I ran for U.S. Congress in my home state of Maine, District 2. I've been an upstanding, tax-paying, law-abiding citizen my entire life. And my daughter and me, who's also a U.S. citizen, our rights have been totally ignored by the Department of Justice and the FBI in favor of protecting a criminal alien with a long record of violence and sex abuse.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Mondays, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives.
It was a large room full of people, all kinds. And they had all arrived at the same building at more or less the same time. And they were all free. And they were all asking themselves the same question. What is behind that curtain?
Thank you.